one who was part of the people who invented and constructed and made the Stanford-Binet intelligence test. If you've heard of it, that's very famous, surely.
Yes.
Anyhow, he's had a good background and good parents, and he will give us a good paper, I'm sure. Determined wrong.
Thank you. Is the mic live here? Is that appropriate distance for the mic? Okay. Adam, Eve, and Modern Science 1. This is a two-part paper. One is a general discussion, and then the last half of the paper gives a specifically Mormon point of view. The last two pages. Abstract 1. For years, I sided with science teachers against fundamentalists who wanted our public schools to teach the creation of everything a few thousand years ago as an alternative scientific theory. But now one of the three skeletons in the closet of science is sticking its head out the closet door and attracting public attention. This can be healthy, but doesn't detract from the many sound findings of science. The firm belief by most scientists that chance acted randomly in the past is being exposed as an act of faith on their part. That's a part of the science. Introduction. Modern science surrounds us these days. The global positioning system, GPS, uses Einstein's theories of special and general relativity to find locations precisely using orbiting satellites. Computers and modern televisions are based on the quantum mechanics of solid-state physics. The Hubble telescope orbits the Earth and sees a galaxy 13 billion light-years away. Light travels 186,000 miles per hour. Geologists and paleontologists determine that a circle of rocks 112 miles across in Mexico's Yucatan Peninsula was made by an asteroid that killed off the dinosaurs 65 million years ago. Radioactivity dates Earth at 4.6 billion years. The whole universe is three times that age since it started with the Big Bang. Darwin. In 1859, Charles Darwin published On the Origin of Species, claiming a single species of finch had evolved into several new species on the Galapagos Islands 600 miles west of Ecuador. These birds had different beaks and diets on various islands. Darwin's book didn't say humans had evolved, but others quickly did. At that time, most geologists believed the Earth was at least tens of millions of years old. Biblical creation. Then and now, biblical literalists argued God created Adam and Eve in the Garden of Eden about 6,000 years ago after creating the heavens and earth no more than 12,000 years ago. The book of Genesis said God made Adam from clay and made Eve from Adam's rib on the sixth day of creation. But one day is with the Lord as 1,000 years, according to Psalm 90.4 and 2 Peter 3.8. Scientific breakthroughs. Until 1924, many astronomers claimed our Milky Way galaxy contained the whole visible universe and was only 24,000 light years in diameter, and thus 12,000 years old. Then Edwin Hubble proved the Great Spiral Nebula in Andromeda to be a galaxy like our Milky Way, but over a million light years away. About then, radioactivity proved some Earth rocks to be billions of years old, and primitive human fossils were found in South Africa that were not just a different species of human, but a different genus, differing from us as much as a hyena differs from a dog. The conflict between science and a literal reading of Genesis could no longer be dismissed as scientific error. Human fossils today. We now have a sequence of human-like fossils, including many species and several genera, going back to over 4 million years ago. The oldest show ape-like heads on erect bodies. They walked on two legs, but had stiff wrists inherited from their knuckle-walking days. The earliest known stone tools made by human ancestors are 2.6 million years old, found in eastern Africa. DNA. All life on Earth uses helical molecules of DNA to convey hereditary information from one generation to the next. DNA is found in every cell. Crime labs use DNA like fingerprints. They also use DNA to determine the parents of abducted small children. Biologists find we share 98.5% of our DNA with chimpanzees and share 25% of our DNA with radishes. All human races share 99.9% of their DNA. The DNA differences between different types of plants and animals correlate well with their traditional clarification by physical form. The oldest fossils, microscopic single cells, are 3.8 billion years old. All this points to a common origin for all life on Earth about 4 billion years ago. Intelligent design. The massive evidence above has helped American courts declare creation science a religious dogma, which does not belong in our public schools. Leaving fundamentalist dogma behind, however, a new group of anti-evolutionists have arisen under the banner of intelligent design. Now at the heart of a bitter debate in Ohio on how science and evolution should be taught in public schools, they delve into the complexities of biology, searching for evidence that random mutations and natural selections are not enough to explain the wonders and diverse forms of nature. They point to the defensive apparatus of the bombardier beetle, the fine bony structures and nerves of the mammalian inner ear, the ion channels and pumps of nerve networks that underlie vision, the hair-like filaments of bacteria swimming with, and the exquisite biochemical cascade that causes blood to clot quickly after an injury. They don't say who or what does the intelligent designing to avoid charges they're trying to sneak God back into the public schools. No Free Lunch. This is the title of a new book on intelligent design by William Dembski, a mathematician and philosopher at Baylor University in Texas. He talks about evidence for systems that have no function until you have an integrated package in place. In some ways, this discussion traces back to Aristotle's musings on acorns and oak trees. Today, it's updated by a constant stream of academic talk on the internet and at science and religion conferences. Nevertheless, the overwhelming majority of biologists hold that no leap of faith is necessary to explain any biological system. They all arise through random mutations in DNA combined with the natural selection of ecosystems. Life's Big Leap is the title of a short article in Discover magazine, May 2002, page 13, if some stands now. In it, William McGinnis, a biologist at the University of California at San Diego and graduate student Matthew Rongshagen, described the role of a protein called UBX in the leg development of a multi-legged arthropod. The loss of just one peptide from this protein can repress leg development over most of the body. This is, quote, this is the first evidence that small mutational changes in the gene can contribute to a very large jump in evolution. Jumps such as the rise of insects with only six legs from creatures with many more legs. Bad mutations. All this is related to the known fact that the vast majority of mutations are harmful or neutral compared with to the few that can be beneficial. The problem is especially acute in animals that produce not thousands of eggs or offsprings, but just a few, as humans do. Imagine taking the plans for an airplane on a computer disk and introducing random changes through static and transmission. What are the chances that the plane would be improved? Could new and better types of planes be created by blind static? Or would you just get a lot of planes that flew poorly and dangerously? Proving randomness, Mr. Mark. Science, likes both randomness and strictly deterministic laws, such as the law of gravity as it operates in the solar system, because such laws can be mathematically modeled. How could intelligent design by an unknown agent or principle be treated mathematically? Yet no proof of any event in the past was really that no proof that any event in the past was really random is possible. How could one do a controlled experiment on it? And this is caps. Scientists believe in randomness of past events strictly as an act of faith. Okay, second skeleton in the closet of science arises from the paradox of Zeno, about 342 to 270 BC, Greek founder of Stoicism. Zeno said to reach a doorway, say 4 feet away, one must first go halfway, 2 feet, then halfway again, 1 foot, then halfway a third time, half a foot, and so on for an infinity of halfway steps. Modern math is okay with this, but the laws of physics completely break down at distances equal to the 116th step. Named the Planck length after the founder of quantum mechanics. But so what? A sphere this diameter is as much smaller than an atom as an atom is smaller than the entire solar system with all its outer comets half a light year across. 10 to the 70th power different in volume. Never hard to comprehend. Third skeleton in the closet of science is that 90% of the mass of our entire universe is, quote, dark matter, unquote, invisible at all wavelengths and detected only by its gravity. It concentrates near galaxies like our Milky Way, its density falling off as an inverse square. It's partly stars too small to shine, black holes, lone planets and comets. But at least 80% of the mass of our universe is a form of matter unknown to us, not the electrons, protons, neutrons, photons, and neutrinos science knows about. That is, it's not atoms. It may have caused stars and galaxies to form from the primordial hydrogen and helium gas. It may include lots of spirits and angels. Okay, second part of the paper, Adam and Eve in Modern Science 2, and Mormon View. Abstract 2. The Mormon doctrine of preexistence can reconcile the Genesis story of Adam and Eve with modern science. Adam and Eve can be the first humans and first earth life to have an individual rather than a collective preexistence. Moses 3 is quoted in support of this. Abraham 3 and D&C 138 are quoted to suggest lessons are given to us in this preexistence. Introduction. The Encyclopedia of Mormonism, EM, edited by Daniel Ludlow, copyright 1992 by Macmillan, with 13 contributing editors, mostly from Brigham Young University, will be quoted here as reflecting official attitudes of the LDS establishment. EM on Evolution begins by quoting the first presidency in 1906 under Joseph F. Smith and reshaped in 1925 under Heber Grant. The Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, basing its belief on divine revelation, ancient and modern, declares man to be the direct and lineal offspring of deity. Man is the child of God, formed in the divine image and endowed with divine attributes. EM continues, the scriptures tell why man was created, but they do not tell how, though the Lord has promised that he will tell that when he comes again. D&C 101, verses 32 to 33. 1931, when there was intense discussion on the issue of organic evolution, the first presidency of the church, then consisting of presidents Heber Grant, Anthony Ivins, and Charles Nibley, addressed all the general authorities of the church on the matter and concluded, quote, upon the fundamental doctrines of the church, we are all agreed. Our mission is to bear the message of the restored gospel to the world. Leave geology, biology, archaeology, and anthropology, no one of which has to do with the salvation of the souls of mankind, to scientific research. Well, we magnify our calling in the realm of the church. Upon one thing we should all agree, Adam is the primal parent of our race. EM, page 478. EM, it's Encyclopedia of Mormonism, mind you, on science and religion, continues. In about the 20th century, Einstein, Hubble, and Hawking are leaders. Science itself continues in a state of flux, so that the total collection of scientific ideas at any point in time could never be considered final truth. Realizing this, scholars today recognize that older descriptions of conflict or open warfare between science and Christianity are often mistaken, nor could LDS thinking about science be described in this way, in M. page 1270. Modern humans are generally recognized as beginning with the Cro-Magnons of Europe about 40,000 BC, who, by the way, had larger brains than contemporary mankind. Yeah, well known. By 30,000 BC, they're drawing magnificent cave paintings that have survived to this day. The earliest settlements began shortly after the end of the Ice Ages, 10,000 years ago. The earliest known writings occur in Mesopotamia and Egypt about 3,250 years ago. We have, it is interesting to note that the ancient Sumerians, who lived near the junction of the Hiddekel and Euphrates rivers, see Genesis 2.14, and invented writing, actually listed Adam as their first king. This is perhaps consistent with the biblical Adam having invented writing. The date for Adam differs between the Hebrew and Septuagint versions of Genesis. Our species, Homo sapiens, goes back about a quarter million years with no sharp boundary between earliest Homo sapiens and prior Homo erectus. Okay, genetic drift estimates suggest that all living humans have a common female ancestor who lived very roughly 150,000 years ago in Africa. This is based on the DNA of each cell of outside the cell nucleus, which is inherited only through the female line, a scientific Eve. Genetic drift estimates similarly suggest all living humans have a common male ancestor who also lived very roughly 150,000 years ago in Africa, a scientific Adam. This is based on the DNA of the Y chromosome that exists in each cell of our bodies and is inherited only through the male line. This scientific model does not, however, expect that this Adam and this Eve to have lived at the same time and place. All right. Adam and Eve as, quote, primal parents, unquote, LDS establishment. Can the biblical Adam and Eve be our primal parents in the context of the above modern understanding of how humans evolved? Science says all humans had physical parents, grandparents, great-grandparents, etc. Science does not, however, address the issue of our spiritual souls. How did they evolve? Adam and Eve could be first in some spiritual way. They could be the first to enter into a biblical-type covenant with the Lord, but that does not really make them primal. It just makes them the first to be good in the eyes of the Lord. Could they be first humans to have immortal souls? I think not. That's too big a break with their immediate parents. It makes their parents essentially subhuman not to have immortal souls. We need a distinction that is both unique and subtle. A first in the pre-existence. Latter-day Saints can deal with the above questions and problems much more effectively than other Christians because of their belief in a spiritual pre-existence. We need first to discuss the status of animals in the pre-existence. Moses 3.5 reads in full with my underlines. And every plant of the field before it was in the earth, and every herb of the field before it grew, for I, the Lord God, created all things of which I have spoken spiritually before they were naturally upon the face of the earth. For I, the Lord God, had not caused it to to reign upon the face of the earth. And I, the Lord God, have created all the children of men, and yet not a man to till the ground. For in heaven created I them, and there was not yet flesh upon the earth, neither in the water, neither in the air. All living things were thus created spiritually before they existed physically on earth. Obviously, not every plant that has ever grown can have an individual spiritual existence. Plants of the same species must have a spiritual existence that is collective. Similarly, animals of the same subspecies must have collective rather than individual spiritual preexistence. Animal versus individual preexistence. I tried the above idea out on Larry Hansen, a former state president in my ward, who was rather conservative. He argued, he agreed that similar animals had a collective preexistence. Of course, that doesn't mean he would necessarily agree with other things in this paper. Individual preexistence of the noble and great is found in Abraham 3, 22, verse 22. Now the Lord had shown unto me Abraham the intelligences that were organized before the world was, and among all these there were many of the noble and great ones. 23. And God saw these souls, that they were good, and he stood in the midst of them, and he said, these I will make my rulers. When in evolution does collective preexistence become individual? I say it starts with Adam and Eve. Lessons in the preexistence. Now, Doctrine and Covenants 138 is a vision given to President Joseph F. Smith in Salt Lake City, Utah, on October 3rd, 1918. The only DNC that's not from Joseph Smith, Richard the Prophet. It makes clear the individual, premortal existence of everyone and the lessons they received to prepare them for the physical world with my underlines. Verses 53 and 55. The prophet Joseph Smith and my father Hiram Smith, Brigham Young, John Taylor, Wilford Woodruff, and other choice spirits were all among the noble and great ones who were chosen in the beginning to be rulers of the Church of God. 56. Even before they were born, they, with many others, received their first lessons in the world of spirits and were prepared to come forth in due time. Human spirits are thus prepared in their pre-existence with lessons for the mortal life in an earth simulator. Yeah, I worked on an airplane simulator for pilots trained in a cockpit that acted like an airplane. You've really got a real airplane. Okay, biblical stories and science. We can now take any science conflict with the Old Testament and say it's a lesson from the pre-existence, earth simulator and or metaphor. Noah's flood occurs in tribal legends all over the world, but it's not found in geology or paleontology. So it's a lesson for us in the pre-existence. Eating from the tree of knowledge of good and evil is a metaphor for becoming individuals. Being expelled from the Garden of Eden is a metaphor for acquiring a physical body. And that is the end of my paper. Things to think about.
There's a question and answer session.
We have time for Angela want to say anything? It's up to her.
We have to ask her first. And I've got to introduce her first. All right, the respondent is Angela Campbell, and she is a teacher at Pasadena High School in biology, chemistry, and physics, and she's been in the church for 15 years. You better go the other way.
In order to get the light on in the podium.
So I teach biology at Pasadena High School. I have the same students for 3 years. And they come in as 10th graders, and then I teach them biology, and then when they're juniors, I teach them chemistry, and the few that dare to take physics to seniors, I teach them physics as seniors. So it's nice because I develop a really good relationship with my students, some of whom are working here today in the registration area. And I can say that my experience as a teacher of science is that most of my students are reluctant to learn evolution. They come from many backgrounds, but most of them have some religious background. And all of them are minority students, which makes me the minority. And some of them will even just fail to do all the work required for the unit and take an F and feel good about that because they're defying science. They're standing up for what they believe. This has happened for, I've been teaching 7 years, and it's happened every year. There will be some that just don't want to learn the evil evolution theory. I actually understand these students very well. I was raised in a fundamentalist Christian church called the Church of God in Washington State, and was taught that whatever it says in the Bible is true and anything else is false, and if you believe it, you're showing a lack of faith. And so when I went to Stanford and majored in human biology, and Donald Johanson was my professor, he's the one who discovered Lucy, the 4,000-year-old human, right? I was really challenged at that point to reconcile my fundamentalist faith with what I was being taught by professors that I just stood in awe of and revered, you know? And I think that having mentors in the church, the summer before I went to Stanford, I was baptized and became a member of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. And I had a lot of peers that were also in the same program with me at Stanford. And so having people to talk to about these conflicts and having mentors who could help me figure out my own questions was very useful. And I think that Terry's idea of a collective preexistence versus an individual preexistence is yet another thing that would be a great mentoring tool, a way to get people to think about other ways that these two may not be in conflict. However, in my mind, I think I have the mind of a scientist on this point. I have two minds. There's my faith mind and my science mind, and I've learned to adapt to that almost as if you... I have students that learn to speak one style of English in the classroom or at work, and they have a different style of speaking when they're with their friends, and they switch back and forth between these two effortlessly, and I think about that as the way my mind works on this issue. To me, Adam and Eve are useful symbols. I have, you know, faith that God had a major part in creation, but I don't think of Adam and Eve as the first humans in my science mind. That just doesn't work for me. I recognize that there's a whole lot more to learn about that, and there's about evolution in general, and there's a lot of evidence that we don't have and may never have just because of the nature of fossils. I mean, the fossils that we do have represent less than 1% of all the biodiversity possible on Earth because it's so hard to preserve a fossil, you know. So we may never find who the first parents were. And I don't really know if that's important. What I do know is that if you're using just science to look at how humans evolved, you have to go just on the evidence that's available, and we don't have that much. I wanted to just comment on a couple of things that Terry pointed out. One of the things he pointed out was that the thing about mutations, bad mutations, in the science, the more science-oriented section of his paper, there is sort of a preconception, I guess, that evolution only occurs when a mutation happens, and that is not really so at all. One of the major reasons Darwin is a breakthrough, his thinking was a breakthrough, is because he wasn't necessarily saying that mutations caused change, but that variety causes change. That there's a huge variety in our species, so to speak, whatever species you're looking at, and that through all kinds of combinations of events, interactions with the environment, the organisms that survive are the ones that have the best match between their environment and their genes, I guess you could say, or their physical traits. And I think that idea is much easier for me to buy into as a scientist, because you can see it happening. This is how I open with my students. I always bring up the pepper moths in England, and I don't know, you probably all know this story, but prior to the Industrial Revolution, the pepper moths in the city of London were these little beautiful moths with white wings, kind of little speckled black on their white wings, and they lived on the birch trees, which were white. They had white bark. And every now and then, a black one would show up because there's variety in the gene pool, but they were an easy mark for the birds that ate them, and so they would be gobbled up and their genes wouldn't survive very long. However, during the Industrial Revolution, there was a lot of smoke and soot in the air, and it would settle on the buildings and the trees, and it changed the bark of the birch trees black. And so the white pepper moths were an easy mark for the birds. The birds got really fat that year. And the black pepper moths survived longer and were able to reproduce and pass on their genes. So there was a flip in the population. With a short period of time, a few years, there weren't very many white pepper moths. They were much rarer. And there were all these black pepper moths instead. And this, again, is not because there was a mutation. There was no mutation. The black genes always existed in this population. They were just not as adapted for their environment. So the variety helped this species survive when the environment changed. And I think that, the tail end of that story is in the 1900s, 1960s, I think, they went and cleaned up all the trees in London. And so the population switched back. Now they're all white again. But this helps my students understand that change does occur, and it's very influenced by the environment. And so, you know, maybe that again fits into, it could fit into Terry's simulator, Earth simulator, pre-existence model with the idea that spirits that can adapt and change with the environment were ready to come to Earth and be our first parents or something like that. And another thing I wanted to point out was he talked about DNA. Which one was this? About the mitochondrial DNA. We have a theoretical, it's under genetic drift in the second part. He says this is based on the DNA of each cell of outside the cell nucleus, which is inherited only through the female line, a scientific Eve. Now, I don't know if people are familiar with this theory. We all have cells that have a nucleus where our personal DNA is kept under lock and key under several membranes. And then outside the nucleus, there are a lot of other organelles that do the work of the cell, like manufacturing ATP for energy and storing fats and things like that. And one of those organelles is the mitochondria, which has its own DNA, which is an interesting thing all on its own, because it seems like mitochondria were sort of like bacteria living off on their own, and then they found a way inside of a cell one day and became a symbiotic organism of the foreign cell. But anyway, they have their own DNA, and we inherit all of our mitochondria from our mother, because she supplies the egg, which has all the good stuff in it. The father only supplies a little piece of DNA. That's it. So all of the... We can attribute most of what's wrong with us to our mothers, or most of what's right with us. Because we get more cell mass from the mom. And if you look at just the mitochondrial DNA, it's easy to sequence. There's not a whole lot of it. You can see particular genes, and they're in a particular place on the genome. They out, like, if you were to take them, right, if you were writing all the letters down, A, G, C, T, T, G, C, A, you could find all the places where they form, they make sense, where they form a gene. And if you compare the mitochondrial DNA from someone who grew up in Africa to the mitochondrial DNA of someone who grew up in, say, Russia or India or someplace else, there's not very many differences between the DNA and the spacing where the genes are. In fact, if you look at chance, there's a much greater chance that there would be more differences if people didn't have one common ancestor. That's how it's based. So there is chance. There's math that plays into that theory. It is a theory. I mean, it's really hard to prove based on that there is one Eve, mother of us all. But similar things are done with other organisms to see how closely related they are. Like, you know, how related are sunflowers and corn, for example? They have similar genes for things like hormones, and if you look how far apart the genes are, you can see how closely related the plants are. So it's a common practice. Let's see. And the other thing I was going to say is that, you know, there are creation stories in every culture, I'm sure. You probably grew up hearing other people's creation stories. My parents bought me creation stories from Hawaii and Japan and Africa and all kinds of places to read when I was a little kid. And so, certainly, the Christian creation story is no different. We all want to know where we came from and who the first people were, and that's typically what a creation story is about, right? Our particular creation story, though, in the Old Testament in Genesis, there's a theme. I don't know how many Mormons pick this up because I don't know how well we study the Old Testament as members of this church, but when I was in the Church of God, that's just, you know, there were only two things, the Old and New Testament, so you studied them a lot, and so I did. And one of the main themes from the Old Testament is that God picks people. He chooses people. He chose Abraham. He chose Isaac. He chose Jacob. He chose everybody down the line to Christ. And maybe he chose Adam too. And if he chose Adam, then there must have been someone to choose from. And that goes back to my theory of variety. There's variety in species, and God sees whatever he needs to see in someone in order to pick them to be the father of the next line. And that element of choice, that God chooses people, is actually very comforting to me. So, I mean, this is one place where my spiritual mind and my scientific mind do blend a little bit. Because if God chooses people and let us know about it, then that means we've been chosen too, in the sense that he wants us to know. We've been chosen to know about it. So I think that's about all I have to say. I'm sorry I didn't have more intelligent things prepared, but I hope that you'll be forgiving. I have a lot of questions right there.
I don't think you need to apologize for that. It was very insightful. I thought that was very good. Okay, do we have any questions? Now is the question and answer time. And please state who you want to ask the question of.
Yes. Maybe Angela should also come up here to the podium.
Go ahead.
I'm just a little confused. This is for Terry. So you're saying prior to Adam and Eve, it's more like a collective? When the intelligence, in other words, intelligence is where individual.
You need to repeat the question.
Okay. The question is, am I saying that prior to Adam and Eve, that intelligences were collective? I'm only talking about in the spiritual pre-existence. People who were lived on Earth prior to Adam and Eve, as I believe many humans did, had their own individual, you know, intelligence on Earth. But I was saying that in the spiritual pre-existence, was suggesting that that was a collective experience. It wasn't all sorted out by individuals prior to Adam and Eve.
Could that follow then down through like Carl Jung's collective unconsciousness?
Ah, does that follow through like Carl Jung's collective unconscious? I actually had the final sentence of the paper as this relates to Carl Jung's collective unconscious ideas, and then I added something and I ran out of space for it, and he said, well, this is Carl Jung, you know, I don't want to explain him, I don't have time to explain him. So, very pertinent question that you should raise of Carl Jung and his concept of the collective unconscious, because that's, yes, that was a line I had in the paper to end with until I, at the last moment, would fit in there, yes, that we would, things from the collective unconscious would be things that we experienced, you know, in the pre-existence in the Earth simulator. The world may have been flat there in the Earth simulator. It's the flat Earth ideas appealed to people so much. And the it's a subtle distinction between being collective rather than individuals in the pre-existence. If you're collective, you could not make a covenant with the Lord prior to your earthly existence. Yes?
Yeah. It sounds like you're almost describing the concept of organizing intelligence into a sphere. That might have been the point where we stopped being a collective and actually gained this individual pre-existence that you're talking about.
Okay, I need to repeat that question. okay. The question is that the point at which we... You fill it in.
Why don't you come up and ask the question?
You ask the question into the mic, yeah, because that is a subtle question you're asking. Yeah,
I'm sorry, I understand. At least what I was taught growing up in the church is that this concept of there was a point where this intelligence, whatever that is, got organized into individual spirits. And I'm wondering if that somehow relates to this idea that you're coming up with.
That's fine with me to say that. Yes, and I don't have, you know, a detailed description of this, and we only have kind of hints of it in the various forms of scriptures. So I'll be happy to take that idea. Someone have a question for Angela?
Jewish tradition clearly states that Adam was chosen. Adam was called to be the first man. And that's a long and deep tradition that goes back many, many thousands of years and long antedates the current religious fervor about literality, that they never believed that that was literal. Is that what you see as a possibility for explaining what's going on?
Repeat.
Yeah, Jewish tradition does say that Adam was chosen, and that the Jews don't really hold Adam as the first, necessarily first human, but first chosen. So I guess the question is, do I see that as something that the Jewish tradition as something that could be more realistic? Is that kind of the question?
The Bible's full of all sorts of references to marrying the daughters of men,
right,
to giants.
And the daughters of men.
And all these things that are going on, and you're going, you know, what is all this? It's not well explained to us.
Early angels, that's right. I agree. I think that... There's other references too that are a little difficult, especially for fundamental ones to deal with. Like, there's references to gods, not God, but gods, and in the sons of men marrying the daughters of God. So Yeah, I think that it's impossible to know. I mean, Moses wrote Genesis, right? I mean, he wrote Genesis like 500 years after the fact, after it had all, you know, after Adam had lived. And he was basing it on verbal traditions that had been handed down. And so who really knows, even from a religious point of view, just looking at the text, who really knows what was going on? We only have what was written there and how it's been translated. And absolutely, I believe there are other people running around who have that in mind.
Make a comment. I thank Angela for bringing up the question of not, there's not just mutations, but there's combining different types of genes and shuffling them around. It brings up the whole issue of sex. Why do we have male and female as God has created all higher creatures, not simple single-celled creatures don't have sex in the same sense, although they do some gene swapping, even at the single-celled level. But yes, in terms of evolution and in terms of just how people are, we, of course, are, because you get some genes from your father and a few more from your mother, there is a lot of recombination of genes. And if you think about a poker hand, what's a good poker hand? Well, it's nice to have, you know, high cards, aces and kings and queens and so on. But also, it's also a question of the combination of cards, that four of a kind, four twos are going to beat out a couple of aces and things. So, you know, and a royal flush beats out everything. Would exponentially last longer because of cooler temperature, but they would all in enough time evaporate. So now some black holes are no longer forever. This is one of the reasons Stephen Hawking's got a Nobel Prize. So you have to be a little careful on science, you know, about saying, you know, always or never about it. Things and our viewpoints of science can change.
Okay, anything else? I guess, yes, go ahead.
Just want to say thank you for your comments on metaphors. As an English major, it appeals to me. And I learned that from Walt Bandon as well, Institute of Religion at Utah. He talked about the Bible being a religious record, not a scientific one.
Okay, now I'm going to repeat that to the microphone, that you're, who was that at Utah? I was talking about the Bible being a religious record rather than a scientific
record.
Great
teacher of religion at the Institute in
Lowell Binion. Lynn Binion has been my bishop at my home ward in Mountain View, related to Lowell Binion, so I know that family.
Okay, I guess the session is now over. You're free to leave.